renegade economist and say, yeah.
Economics for activists. Economics is being made. Economics is being made. These are the tools activists need. How can we kill them? What motivates them? Why do people spend money? Understand the basics.
Eddie Obeid, New South Wales corruption, it's all unleashing, and today we have the man who broke the Murdoch scandal earlier this year, Neil Chenoweth from the Australian Financial Review. Very excited to have him on the show, discussing the windfall profits that landowners can make in their sleep. And welcome to the show with your host, Carl Fitzgerald, here on The Renegade Economist. Rather excited to finally get Neil Chenoweth on the show. Lots have been going on in the press if you've been checking out the ICAC review into corruption in New South Wales. It's been madness. There's been all sorts of major planning minister Ian McFarlane in the press, on the ropes. Everyone's out baying for the blood of the corrupt New South Wales Labor Party. Well, here on the Renegade Economist, we're saying, look, this happens all the time. It's just a matter that this time a politician's been busted. Usually it is a development lobby who are on the inside. And anyone on our Real Estate for Ransom Facebook group would have seen an interesting story today from Tweed Heads about the developments going on there. The council's finally fighting back against the developer-friendly councillors on board there. So let's get into this interview. A few gremlins snuck in. I'm not sure whether ASIO was listening or not, but apologies for that. But here we go with today's interview.
Very excited to have on the Renegade Economist one of Australia's leading investigative journalists, Neil Chenoweth from the Australian Financial Review. I've been trying to lock him down for an interview for the best part of the year since the Murdoch pay TV scandal erupted earlier this year. He's just recently released a book on the Murdoch Pirates. He's been a long-time investigator of the Murdoch family since 1991. I think was an infamous article, Neil, you put out that brought some of Murdoch's behaviour to light. But let's get on to Murdoch later in the interview. We wanted to start off talking about the largest corruption story since the Rum Rebellion that's unfolding at present in New South Wales. It surrounds the Labor Party power broker, Mr. Obeid. Can you give an overview of what's unfolding for us Victorians?
Sure. Now, you have to bear in mind that almost all of the stories that are shaped around the opening address that Council Assisting the Independent Commission Against Corruption gave on Monday of last week. Now, he's simply saying this is where the investigation is going to go in the next 5 months' time, and we are yet to see what substantiates the claims that he's made, and I'm sure there will be a strong defence made. Having said that, the picture he paints is a fairly... I mean, it's just a bizarre one. I mean, you get the picture of a government that's largely out of control, which is controlled by a particular faction within the right of the Labor Party, which then controls the entire caucus. And that is ultimately controlled by Mr. Obeid. He's Lebanese, has been in the upper house since about the mid-1990s and has just consolidated his power through that time.
And so the corruption scandal surrounds, of course, a land purchase that happened in a rural New South Wales in Byalong that seems to have resulted in a huge windfall gain for him and his family company.
Yes, one of the funny things is, I mean, you saw the former New South Wales Premiers Maurice Yemma and Nathan Rees testify last week, and the consistent thing is that Eddie Obeid wasn't so much interested in the mining department so much as he wanted Ian MacDonald, his ally, to be the planning minister, because much of his play seemed to be based around her property place. So late 2007, he buys a very nice property near the town of Bylong in New South Wales for about $3.65 million. He buys it from the former tax advisor of Kerry Packer, a guy called John Cherry, who has it as a beef property. He has no idea of what's beneath it. Eddie Abid perhaps has, because he was a mines minister some years back. What happens then is there's a whole series of negotiations where it becomes clear that Eddie Abid's sons know that there's coal underneath this deposit, and not just that, they know that the government, the mines minister, Ian McDonald, is going to call for expressions of interest for coal miners to develop that seam. And it seems such a mundane small thing, but essentially they negotiate a series of deals for their land to be rebought at four times the price that they paid, but also they have some friends and associates also buy land which also gets bought out. So the Abid stand to make about $18 million from these deals, which is big cash by itself, but it's just a drop in the bucket for the real profits that are about to be made from this land. According to the council assisting the commission last week, it ends up McDonald and Obeid, it seems, arrange for Cascade Coal to get the mining rights for that land. And Cascade Coal has a secret shareholder, which is the Obeid family interests, that have a secret 25% stake. And they cashed themselves out then for $60 million there. That's on top of the land deals that they've done. And then there's a second coal deal as well. So within a period of months, they're looking at realising about $100 million. Now, if that's as corrupt as the council is saying, and that is yet to be proven, it's a staggeringly corrupt series of events there.
So let's just summarise that for the listeners. They bought the property for some $2.6 million, maybe up to $3.9 million, and then with the rezoning from farmland into a mining licence for coal mining there, the value of the property escalated up to $20 million. And then on top of that, they sold rights to the company for some rights in the mining company shares, and they've been under sell those as well for great profit of some $60 million.
Yes, it's essentially that way. Because it's an open cut mine, the miner, whoever it is, has to buy out the existing land. And if you're the person on that land, then you can cut a great deal. So that's where the $18 million profit that they make there came from. But as I said, the guys that end up acquiring the coal lease for $1 million a year later, they're looking to sell it for $500. There's staggering profits being made here.
This is the backbone to the great land game, isn't it? Is knowing where a government is going to allow development to occur and being there in place firstly so that you can benefit from the rezoning windfall gain that's delivered. And this goes on all the time. I suppose this is just a little bit more of an elaborate example because these are political insiders that are basically shuffling the decks to suit themselves.
Yes, and it's interesting because this is a period when the New South Wales government, its electoral prospects had become virtually terminal. There was no way that they were going to win the next election. They were just on, it was just a question of time. And so you have all sorts of deals taking place. And there are also unrelated scandals which are affecting the state government at the same time. I don't know if you recall, there was a businessman called Michael McGurk who was shot outside his home. This has nothing to do with any of the stuff that's in ICAC or the Obeid stuff, but the New South Wales was convulsed at that time with this whole spectre of corruption because he had a tape that he claimed showed corrupt payments being made to public servants for special deals. So it's at this very moment that this unrelated corruption scandal is engrossing New South Wales for politics, that this much larger real scandal is being played out with the coal mines.
So it's almost like a bit of a superannuation plan, Eddie Obeid's plan for him and his family and a few inside friends. Quite shocking.
I mean, Eddie Obeid has many different property developments around the state there. He was actually in a fight with the City of Sydney, by the way, because he had some technology that one of his sons in the companies had the right to sell. The City of Sydney found out actually that they had defrauded them. They were selling their technology as their own offshore. And I say this simply because the City of Sydney has tried to extract cash back from the Obeid family interests. They owed about $17 million, and frankly, they don't have a prayer to get that cash back, I would think.
So what level of transparency is there amongst politicians in New South Wales? They have to declare the property they own. Do they also have to declare the suburb that it's in and reveal any conflicts of interest if major town planning decisions are being looked at or new infrastructure projects that may affect the valuations of their purchases?
Well, in theory, the pecuniary interests register is there. It's just that Eddie Obeid has never filled it in. He would say, this is not my investment, it's my son's, it's my family's, it's this trust. There are 1,000 ways that you can hide what you were doing. And the thing that really is interesting in terms of the way that the ICAC, as the ICAC version of the events plays out, is that in those years, probably it was only newspaper scrutiny was the only thing which really made them change their minds. And so you'd see, for example, they would hide their interest in a coal mine through a company owned by a young mortgage broker. And behind them, he was a lawyer, and behind them was a merchant banker. And it was only when the Fairfax Press began to write stories about these, and they would shuffle them around and having to find new kind of shell companies to hide behind. And the thing is, it was just so easy for them.
I find it fascinating the use of shell companies and how the lucky few can doctor their holdings, and there's virtually little chance we have of finding out who owns what. How many shell companies are there in Australia, and what do you think can be done to tighten up on this sort of white-collar trickery that's possible?
I don't know. That's a big question there. But, I mean, I think this whole system works because there are law firms and accounting firms that work out how it's possible to do these things. And some of the lawyers that are appearing as witnesses at ICAC, you have to say, they seem to have an enormous lack of curiosity about what their clients were doing. One of them knew that Eddie Obeid was their client, but didn't know that he was a politician. And he didn't know that because he said he never read the newspapers. They were looking at documents which suggested they had inside information about expressions of interest tenders that these coal leases were about to be told. Well, it didn't occur to them that it might be a breach of the law for that information to have been obtained by the Obeid family interests. So I'd have thought that the professional class has a major kind of role here, and it might be interested to look at what sort of regulation that these guys faced.
How is it playing out in New South Wales now? There's a ban on developer donations to the political parties. Do you think that's going to have any major difference in reducing these sort of rezone windfalls that property lobbies have been chasing for eons?
I think traditionally in Australia, the profits from property have always been so stellar that they overwhelm any system that's set up for them. So if the donations aren't in front of the books, they'll be behind the books. I'm fairly skeptical about how successful that would be.
Certainly. So you're saying for another 5 months that these investigations are going to go on. Are they focusing just only on this land deal here, or is there a wider scope to it?
There were three separate investigations. They had the first week where they just looked at a car which seemed to be provided at a discounted price for the former treasurer by a member of the Obeid family. then they're looking at these coal leases now. They'll break at about mid-December and then reconvene late to January for a few more months. They're going to be looking at a second deal involving John Maitland, the former National Secretary of the CFMEU. He put a proposal up that he was going to set up a terrain mine on a very valuable coal lease, very near a railway line close to Newcastle. I mean, it was a prospect that's very difficult not to make a great deal of cash from. It turned out that this lease that he helped to obtain within about 15 months was worth about $290 million bucks. His take from it at one stage was looking like it about $27 million. So that's going to be one of the other deals that GICAC looks at next year.
One of the things I find fascinating is Sydney is gridlocked and has huge infrastructure problems, and there's all sorts of desires to fund big projects up there, and they're saying that the only way they can finance these projects is to privatise public infrastructure, as Infrastructure Australia has been beating the drum and every man and his dog has been on about of recent. And here we have these massive windfall gains, you know, some 20/60, $80 million at least just through a couple of transactions here. And they're going on day by day. We're having these rezonings, adding millions of dollars in land values. Do you think that with people like Lucy Turnbull at the Cities of Sydney expert panel looking at the role of land value capture, of capturing this rising value of the earth to finance the infrastructure that's so needed, do you think these power brokers at the upper echelons of society are going to see in the goodwill of such economic efficiency?
Oh, well, it's a big call. I mean, I think Sydney does have major infrastructure problems and issues and no easy ways to there. Look, I really don't know. I guess my expertise is in looking at the scenarios when these things go wrong.
Yes, but it's a beautiful set of scenarios playing up for the insiders now, for the stamp duty property sales to be falling, for the government to have cash flow issues, the Standard & Poor's leaning on them saying, watch out, we're going to downgrade your credit rating, the business community screaming about that. They're jumping up and down. 14 of 19 people on the Infrastructure Australia board are involved in some form of infrastructure development or finance, so they're going to benefit greatly out of the proposed $220 billion fire sale of Australia's public assets. And here we have on the side all of these corrupt deals going on, and it would just be nice to see a little bit more of analysis looking at how the wider economic functions play into being. And
you're on 3CR with your host Carl Fitzgerald, the Renegade Economist here. Today we're discussing with Neil Chenoweth, the man who broke the Murdoch scandal earlier this year, the Eddie Obeid corruption case, the windfall gains made out of the good old land game. We'll go back to the interview right now.
Let's move over to the Murdoch scandal now, and very interested in reading your book, The Murdoch Pirates, out earlier this year. And everyone knows about the phone hacking scandal that Murdoch and his team Rebecca Books at World of the News put out, but less people know about what I've been seeing as probably a bigger element to the scandal, and that is the pay TV hacking of their cards there.
Sure. Look, it starts off with a terribly mundane thing, that little smart card that you stick into your Foxtel box or your Austar box. It has a little chip on it, and that chip talks to you, to your set-top box, and says, okay, this person's paid their subscription, they can watch Foxtel, that they can watch TV. It's used all around the world by different pay TV operations. They use different sorts of cards. The problem is, it's easy to pirate these cards. In the mid-1990s, Rupert Murdoch found that his kind of card, which was developed by an Israeli subsidiary called NDS, was being widely pirated so badly that, when you think about it, it really it doesn't seem all that bad. I mean, you're approached by someone in the pub and saying, look, rather than paying, $100 a month to Foxtel for pay TV, I'll sell you a card for $100 and you won't ever have to pay again. If you got in the United States some of those pay TV operations, they had a million pirate cards. That's like $1 billion worth of income that they don't get. So suddenly you're talking huge numbers. Now, what happened was that in the phone hacking scandal, you've got several thousand people, all damaged and hurt, but in a fairly small amount, comparatively. But it adds up. It'll cost them $500 million to $1 billion to pay out there. In the smart card stuff, we're at six companies around the world, some of the largest pay TV operations in that you can see, all sued in NDS at different times, accusing them of pirating their product. And they, each of them were basically claiming damages of $1 billion each for each one. So it's exponentially larger than the telephone hacking scandal. Part of what happens then is that facing their own her piracy problem, Rupert Murdoch's NDS company decides, well, when you're facing hackers, what do? You need to hire spies, you need to hire intelligence agencies, you need to hire former policemen. You end up with this network of your own private security firm. And the thing is, at some stage, you think, well, we're trying to stop piracy, but gee, wouldn't it be easier if the pirates were attacking someone else? You know, it's like having your house being broken into and you're thinking, well, gee, wouldn't it be nicer if the thieves robbed our next door neighbour? And how can we help that happen?
So you're saying that Murdoch saw that this was easy to hack the cards and set up his own little division to go and hack his competitors. That's what came about from it.
Sure. Now, this wasn't something that Rupert Murdoch is directly involved in, but it becomes a series of the consequences. You first of all, you target pirates, and then you've got these spies working for you, and they're saying, "Well, we'll hire some of these hackers, and they'll teach us how they do it, and then we'll reverse engineer our own cards." And then they think, "Well, why don't we reverse engineering the competition's cards and see how they work?" And then suddenly, the secrets, the reverse engineering of these competitive cards are suddenly released on pirate websites, and it proved completely devastating to Rupert Murdoch's pay TV rivals.
And that's where it really gets interesting, because we've all heard about the secrets being stolen by the Chinese from American corporations and the corporate espionage going on. But if what you're saying is true, and the next stage to this story really is what blew my mind, is that Murdoch's competitors lost market value because their cards were being hacked and sold on the open market. And then what did Murdoch do in terms of consolidating his market power in the pay TV industry?
Well, just looking at some examples, Canal Plus was the biggest pay TV operator throughout Europe. It was in about 17 countries. Its secrets were released on a website, and the forensic evidence points directly back to NDS. It cost them billions of dollars. Today, they're in about three countries. When they sued NDS over it, they were in such a bankrupt state that, in fact, they had to accept simply that Rupert Murdoch would buy their Italian operation, and that's essentially the large Sky Italia operation that News Corp owns. When DirecTV was a client of News Corp, they actually hired News Corp to keep pirates off them, and they had about a million or so pirates anyway. And you can see News Corp then decides to buy DirecTV, and they're holding back on the anti-piracy stuff because, well, who knows why, but the effect is DirecTV, the value when it when News Corp buys it is less because of the piracy that takes place.
And so he got to buy up his competitors at a cheaper price and consolidate his market power, because all of a sudden there were these hacked cards out there on the market.
Yes, I mean, it's just a function of the numbers. I mean, DirecTV had about a million pirate cards out there. That's $1 billion worth of income that he didn't get. Then if you're buying it, well, you multiply that income by about 7 or 8 times. So you've reduced the value of a major corporation by $7 or $8 billion, and that's enormous.
Absolutely enormous. And you're saying that the evidence is mounting up. I do remember that Media Watch had a bit of a dig at the whole story that erupted around about April this year. There were some concerns there over what was written in the Financial Review. What was your response to Media Watch's attack on some of the integrity of this information?
A few things. Now, you have to say, NDS has been sued five, six times, and it has emerged unscathed from that. Now, at least two of the cases, it's emerged unscathed simply because it's bought the opposition out. It's bought out DirecTV. It did the deal with Canal Plus. The rest of the cases are largely because the evidence went beyond the statute of limitations there. But in terms of the Media Watch stuff, I guess News was really upset about what we wrote about what they were doing within Australia. I should say part of what our stories were based around is that I had access to the emails from the hard drive at one of the people that were in this operational security division. He was the former commander of Scotland Yard, a guy called Ray Adams, one of the most controversial figures in British policing history. Those emails showed quite clearly that their person overseeing security in Australia had obtained a copy of a software to hack Foxtel, and she was suggesting that it should be disguised to hide a source, and that it's before it was released to the market. Then NDS has said, well, look, by release to the market, that doesn't mean we were going to sell it. It simply means that we were going to let a debtor in the market know that your card has been hacked. That's not the way that the emails read, but that's certainly the defense that they made. Now, since that time, if you look in my book, just in the period about 3 or 4 weeks later, when this software has been adapted, you see a piracy website called SOIC, the House of Ill Compute, that the NDS runs in Britain. You see Lee Gibling, the guy that runs it, actually offering a Foxtel piracy software, saying, look, I have been offered this software. It's on sale for $5,000 US. This is the stuff which will and Foxtel has been well and completely hacked. It's certainly much more suggestive that NDS was not just looking at this software or telling Odetta that they had a problem. It speaks much more to me of the fact that this is software there that was on sale.
A huge, huge story there with Neil Chenoweth from the Financial Review here on 3CR's Renegade Economists. I look forward to putting the rest of that interview on the podcast feed. But yeah, it's time to wrap up here on the Renegade Economists. A huge night last night, my report released on the total resource rents of Australia harnessing the powers of monopoly. Wow, what a night. I look forward to bringing you some of the audio and the details on that report next week when it will be live. But stand by for...
And so perhaps they weren't always on Murdoch's side. They were playing both sides of the game.
Well, at that stage, Foxtel wasn't using the NDS smart cards for their satellite. And in fact, it's only with the merger with Austar this year that finally NDS will have complete control of all set-top boxes in Australia. So as long as the opposition was having their smart cards, I think you would there was a feeling there that it was fair game.
So in a way, they've fended off huge legal payouts by buying off their opposition and by the ownership of the company that was suing them. They've quashed those legal challenges.
Yes, and I don't know if you saw the BBC Panorama program that came out just at the time our stories came out, but I know that ITV is looking at whether it's possible to mount an action against NDS now. And again, their problem is the first thing that the NDS's lawyer said to them was, well, you're outside the statute of limitations, it's too late. And that's one of the problems with piracy. It takes a year or two to work out something's happened to your stuff. And then 2 or 3 years to actually find out who's responsible. But by that stage, it's just a bit late.
Neil, just to wind things up, where is the pay TV hacking scandal going? What's coming up in the media landscape, and when will we hear the next level of revelations?
I don't know. My book came out about 3-4 weeks back. I'm still looking to hear back from NDS. There is further stuff coming, but in terms of the timing, it's just a bit hard to say.
Wow, so the statute of limitation saves corporate espionage. That sounds like the summary of this side of the story. Neil Chenoweth, thank you so much for joining us here on The Renegade Economists.
Thanks, great.